Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you're all very welcome back. Now, if you take a tour of Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin, you'll see the resting places of some of our starry's names in history. Michael Collins, of course, the most visited grave there. Charles Stewart Purnell, Brendan Behan, they're all in there. But there's a new book by a tour guide at Glasnevin, and it focuses on the less well-knowns. Warren Farrell, welcome to studio.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Actually, why is it called So Once Was I, the name of the book?
It's a good question. So if you're in the cemetery and you're walking around, like, a lot of headstones have different epitaphs, as you've seen yourself yesterday, Oliver,
when you were up there. Thank you for the tour.
No problem at all. It meant the last 1 hour, so it was an Irish 60-minute tour at the end we got. But in terms of the title of the book, it's from an old epitaph, So Once Was I is a reminder of we're all immortal, we're all going to be there one day, we're going to be in the ground. How are we going to be remembered or forgotten about? So that the line is, remember now as you go by, as you are now, so once was I.
So once was I.
It's kind of just a reminder to everyone, we're all going to end up, maybe it mightn't be Glasnevin, it could be somewhere else, but will we be remembered with a big round tower like Daniel O'Connell? Will we have an unmarked grave? So it's just a reminder that it'd be nice to have our stories remembered one day as well, yeah.
It is, yeah. It's because we were even talking the other day, because I was at a wake at the weekend, and how we praise ourselves for doing death so well in Ireland, don't we?
We do death well. We do.
Do we love graveyards more? But you've met.
I think it's a combination of, like, you know, storytelling. So we love a good story.
That's right. Yeah.
And then we do love a good wake. Well, I'm from Dublin, so wake is not as maybe familiar to me as a local dub.
Is that right?
I've never been to a wake before, I have to say.
They're usually in funeral homes now, aren't
they? Yeah, usually funeral places like maybe Massey's and stuff like that, or Fannigan's. They have their own kind of funeral parlours. Yeah. But I think the combination of storytelling and how we remember someone and having the wake and telling the stories about someone as well, taking the light with the dark, I think we're quite good at that. So places like Glasnevin have that fascination for Irish people. But it does have an international kind of intrigue as well, because there is, like, it's kind of cliche to say, but there is kind of a story for everybody in Glasnevin.
But there is. I mean, that's what life is, isn't it? And that's why we have headstones to mark people who passed, or tiles in terms of the cremations, which are now more and more popular. But walking around yesterday, the celebrities' graves are the draw. Mm. But when I was chatting to you, you find yourself wandering over to random graves and
it was hard to keep you on track yesterday, Oliver. You kept kind of going off like, oh, look at this one, look at this one.
And that's what your book is so beautiful, because it is remembering the lesser known people. That's such a good idea.
And like the book itself, like when I first started writing the book in 2020, so it's taken 4 years to get to this stage.
Right.
But it wasn't envisaged as a book from the start. It was kind of a way of me writing down all these stories I'd learned over time. So I've been in the cemetery 8 years, full time, part time, everything in between. And just so many people telling stories, whether it's having a pint outside the Gravedigger's Pub or John Kavanagh's, whether it's tour guides past and present. But they're all oral stories in many respects, so none of them have ever been physically written down before.
Right.
So I just thought it'd be a nice exercise for me personally to do, firstly, start jotting down all these stories. And then over time, they started to form quite a lengthy kind of draft text.
Yeah.
The 150 people, it was about 300,000 words. There was a lot in there.
There's so many
poor El Merion Press out there were cut out then to.
We're even going to be forgetting people this morning.
Yeah,
but if you get the book, you get the whole lot.
It's impossible to get everyone.
And you spoke to lots of tour guides present and some retired ones as well.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of stories. I love that. That's how some of the stories came about.
That's where a lot of the stories would have come from now. Yeah. So I'm not like the great oracle. I haven't discovered all of these stories, so I'm not claiming to be that person, but I would like to have them recorded somewhere, so that's the purpose of the book.
It's really an old place, Glasnevin Cemetery, and it's not a graveyard.
No, it's a cemetery, yes. So there's a little bit of a difference. So I suppose if we're going back to Glasnevin when it was set up in 1832 by Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator, the emancipator, and he sets up Glasnevin really to be different to that of a local graveyard or a churchyard.
Yeah,
I mean, at the time, you had penal laws, penal restrictions, going back to the 18th century in Ireland. The Reformation had placed harsh restrictions on the Catholics, and how you buried your dead became very, you know, contentious. Restricted burial rights, funeral services, paying really high prices for the right to be buried in what became established church land. So that was Church of Ireland, you know, at the time. So for Daniel O'Connell, when he sets up Glasnevin, he doesn't want it to be an unorganized local parish churchyard. It's meant to be an organized planned space.
Right.
Records are kept, amassed. Headstones tell you the story, and it's a garden cemetery. So it's very much based on what you might see in like Père Lachaise in Paris.
Yeah.
That was the prototype garden cemetery. And I know we joked yesterday about Napoleon Bonaparte. He actually decreed in 1804 that all local churchyards were deceased burials in France, mm-hmm. and they were to move towards the cemetery plan. So that's where he set up Père Lachaise.
And the great legacy.
Yeah, the great legacy. You don't immediately
forget the battles.
To.
It's
yeah,
a bureaucracy.
Forget Waterloo. It's all about, yeah. It's all about cemeteries. But from those ideals on the continent, they eventually reach Ireland. And so you get places like Glasnevin set up. You get Mount Jerome on the other side of the city set up in 1836. Both cemeteries, Mount Jerome and Glasnevin, despite local kind of Dublin beliefs, they're both non-denominational from the start.
Brilliant,
however, like local Dubliners would probably have maintained that, yes, Glasnevin is non-denominational, but it's kind of for the Catholics of Dublin.
Yeah.
Whereas Mount Jerome, yes, it's non-denominational, but more for the Protestant population.
Traditionally.
Of Traditionally,
than
yeah.
Actually officially,
but that doesn't diminish the fact that there is people of all different faiths.
Yeah.
Kind of just scattered around the grounds in Glasnevin.
And you have some of your own people there, don't you?
I have loads of family up there. So
family Glasnevin.
There is...
We've got to say the graveyard is attached when it's attached to a parish or a church, isn't it? And the cemetery is when it's actually purpose-built. Yeah. But you have a good few relatives.
I do. So we have mainly the Farrell side of my family and my grandmother's side. One of her relations, she kindly gave me permission to write about her in the book. Her name is Mary Lacken, and she was a fish dealer basically in the inner city of Dublin. And in 1896, if you go to the Irish Times archives, you'll see boy killed by his mother. And basically, her young son, Patrick, just 16 at the time, he was moaning about the way she'd cooked his eggs for breakfast. And so she kind of picked up a pair of fish dealing scissors that she'd gut the fishes with, and she threw them out of anger. But he ended up killing poor old Patrick, just 16 years old. And so she goes to Green Street Courthouse. There's a big case. It's all documented in the Irish Times.
Yeah.
She goes to the Grange Gorman for 2 years, and she dies in 1900 destitute in the North Dublin Union. The husband ended up in the same way, and Patrick, the son that died 16 years of age, he's buried in an unmarked grave quite close to the gravediggers at the John Kavanagh's entrance to the cemetery.
Because there's a poor plot there, wasn't there?
There is. So there would have been where unpurchased grave. So you had the right to be buried in the cemetery.
Is that right?
But you might necessarily have the money to pay to own a grave, which would have been quite common at the time.
So they're unmarked, are they?
Yeah. So like Glasnevin is the final resting place of about 1.5 million people.
Yeah.
So the majority of those are more like the stories in my book or my own great-great-great-grandmother. They're in unmarked plots. So... 1.5 million people, only 200,000. 1.5
million?
Yeah, 1.5. So there's actually more people in the cemetery dead than there are alive outside in Dublin City, as of the last census data in 2022.
That's right,
it's a really hard place to kind of track down every story. There's only about 200,000 monuments. When I say only, that's still a lot of monuments, but for the 1.5 million.
We better get into the stories.
Yeah, we better get into the stories, yeah.
Because tell me about Maria Higgins. I mentioned at the start there was somebody who had a unique record. Go on.
Yeah, so Maria's an interesting one. Maria's the only person buried in the cemetery with two separate burial entries.
Mm-hmm.
So she has two graves, essentially. So to go back to the start of her story, the start of the end, really, where she died. She died, apparently, in late July of 1858. Mm-hmm. And the funeral comes up to the original arched entrance of Glasnevin, comes in with the horses with the black plumes and the hearse. And
lovely, yeah.
They come in on the 31st of July, 1858, and Charles, the husband, is there, his brother John and the brother-in-law, and she's lowered into the grave. And they think that's it, you know, another normal funeral, job done. But then 2 years later, a supposed Maria Higgins shows up on Nassau Street in a solicitor's office, and she's not best pleased that she's complaining about her final will and testament. It turns out Maria had faked her own death to get her hands on £500, was left her in a family will, so that the will stipulated that she'd only get the money after her death for her children's well-being, and in the absence of children, it'd go to the beneficiary of her will. So,
Of her own will, yes.
So she thought, look, we'll fake my death. The husband and stuff can be the beneficiary in the will, and we'll get all the cash, and we'll have a happy second life. But what transpired was, in the newspapers, there was a massive case.
The
fraudulent burial case. It went to Green Street Courthouse as well.
International attention.
International attention across the UK. But Maria Higgins actually found out that the husband and her own brother-in-law, John, they'd actually changed the will, which had the effect of cutting her out of the picture. Mm-hmm. So they probably thought, like, once she's supposedly dead, she's not going to come back to claim that this has been a mistake.
Yeah,
how wrong could they have been? she's there, and long story short, 13 years later, she dies for real, 24th of July, 1871, is laid to rest in a separate plot, which is unmarked today. John, the brother, he went off with all the money, supposedly.
Is that right?
Charles, the husband, got 2 years imprisonment, along with her brother, William.
And along with nothing.
And the doctor that had signed the death cert to sign off on this whole thing, he died before it ever went to trial. Mm-hmm. He died of liver failure. Apparently he was quite fond of Paris whiskey, so...
And that was his payment.
That was his payment for signing the death cert, yeah, exactly. So, lived once, buried twice. It would be a good line to sum up Maria's story.
So Maria Higgins has two... She's the only person who has two...
Only person with two burial records, though she died once. Yeah.
She got off, by the way. She
did. She was found innocent. She kind of argued that she was coerced to go along with the whole plan.
Sexism worked out in her favour. Yeah,
No. But there was even someone in the court case called Catherine Codd, who was someone to give evidence. And there's a whole cast of characters in the newspapers. But it's very interesting to read through in Irish newspaper archives. If you have a little subscription on that, you can go through them all. And it's really interesting.
Oh, I bet you do. Tell us about the most bitten man in show business.
Yeah, the most bitten man in show... Interesting segue. But Bill Stevens. So Bill Stevens was an ill-fated lion tamer. Mm-hmm. And he basically made his living. He had three lions. One lioness, two lions. But on the 11th of November 1951, if you had been coming out of the cinema on Fairview Strand, I think it's a Tesco Express today, but... people came out, they were going to see this movie called Jungle Capers, and they come out onto the street and there was an actual lion on Fairview Strand. The link of the lion had escaped from its enclosure where Bill was keeping them safe in the off-season. He worked for Fawcett Circus. Essentially, Bill tried to recapture the lion. In the end, the guards had to shoot the poor old animal, and he wanted to then add a new kind of terrifying element to his act. So he persuaded Dublin Zoo to sell him a lion, which was called Prince Albert. Mm-hmm. He renamed the lion Pasha because he thought that was more exotic, I suppose.
Yeah, he was right.
And his wife May was part of the act as well. And she was seen as quite exotic from the East. You know, that's what she was branded as. She wasn't actually that exotic. She was from the East Wall in Dublin, which is as exotic as it kind of got. But it was a captivating performance. Like, he put his head inside the lion's mouth. He'd feed the lion with his own teeth. And May would lie down, the lions would jump back and forth over her. But this particular lion, Pasha, had a bit of a bad rep. It had apparently killed before in Antwerp Zoo.
Lovely.
So naturally, he thought that was a perfect fit for the act. But in 1953, of January of that year, he was trying to impress a talent scout from the Ringling Brothers Circus in the United States.
Which he was mad to get to.
Mad to get to the States to make it big as a big lion tamer. So he puts on a new suit, he goes into the enclosure. The lion Pasha probably didn't recognise the scent of the new suit.
The new clothes. Oh,
yeah.
God.
That's what the Fawcett Circus would maintain was the basis of this. And when he goes into the enclosure, he suffers horrific injuries. The poor old Pasha, poor old Bill, he gets mauled to death by this lion Pasha. He's only 29 years old. Jeez. But he packed a lot into his 29 years. And he's one of the more unusual causes of death in the cemetery, mauled to death by a lion. There is other ones.
It's on the death cert. Mauled.
And on his headstone, there's a little shield that says lion tamer. But it doesn't give his cause of death, which I think is nice.
You can kind of guess. Yeah. Maggie from Mayo, this was a phenomenal woman, and she has a very prominent grave actually in Glasnevin as a result.
Maggie's another interesting one. So we've gone from animals and kind of captivating performances to another type of performance, which she was an operatic singer. Her name was La Margarita Sheridan, or La Prima Donna. And in April of 1958, she passed away. When she passed away, the night that she died, the 17th of April of that year, there was a performance in the Gaiety Theatre. Eamon De Valera, as president, was in the presidential box. Yeah. And the Italian ambassador cut off the performance to take to the stage and announce that La Margarita had passed away, the great prima donna.
Right.
Puccini, Toscanini, they all rated her very highly. Covent Garden, La Scala in Milan. From 1918 to 1930, she was
phenomenal.
The Madame Butterfly, you know, La Boheme.
Puccini himself coaches her. For
yeah, even Puccini coaches her. Marconi, the great inventor, he met her a couple of times and he convinced her to go to Italy. So she had friends in high places.
We have a clip of her, this Madame Butterfly, from 1929. She's very close to De Valera, isn't she?
Very close. She's buried next to her best friend, Kathleen O'Connell, who was the secretary to Dev. So she made arrangements with Cyril Cusack, the actor. She said, I'm happy that I'll be tippy-toes with Kathleen and Glass Nevins. So so she was 69 when she died.
Yeah. We don't have Bram Stoker in Glasnevin. He's buried in London somewhere. But we have Frank Stoker, who's a cousin.
Yeah, Frank. He's a distant cousin. Yeah, Frank, very different to the distant cousin, Bram. Mm-hmm. He was a dentist by profession, Frank. But his
claim to fame is he's the only...
He's the only person to ever be capped by an Irish any international rugby squad and to actually win Wimbledon. So as we come into tennis season, I suppose, good to mention him. Yeah. He won Wimbledon as a doubles partner with his partner from Killiney, Joshua Pimms, 1890 and 1893, the golden age of tennis. We've never quite regained those heights again.
The woman, she's a remarkable name, an unbelievable story. Mary O'Kelly de Galway. That's a good one to end on.
Yeah, this probably has the makings of a drama or some type of film production. But Mary Cummins was her maiden name, born in 1905 in Dublin. Born into a large family, she goes to the Dominican College on Eccles Street and she excels in languages. So she goes to Belgium and she becomes a governess. And while she's over there, the Second World War breaks out. So she decides she's going to join the Belgian resistance. And as far as I'm aware, she's the only person from Ireland to ever joined the Belgian resistance.
Yes, I'd imagine.
She's doing dispatches, collecting weapons, smuggling things, very dangerous stuff. And then she's arrested by the Gestapo and she's sent to a range of awful camps from Dresden to Bremen, Essen, Bergen-Belsen. And then she's scheduled for extermination in Auschwitz. So she's on this train going to Auschwitz, contemplating the last few hours of her life. And then it turns out that the train had derailed. So luckily, the train is sent back to Bergen-Belsen.
Yeah.
And she's there for the liberation of the camp and she survives. But at the time of liberation, she was only 5 stone. She had calcification of the spine. There was a radio documentary done by RTE in 1993. Mm-hmm. And she kind of lived through some of her experience.
20 seconds. We have 20 seconds over here.
So they informed me about all this resistance. They told me it was very, very dangerous. And then they said to me, have you got an English passport or an Irish passport? And I said I had an Irish passport. Oh, they say, ça c'est bien, that's very good. You know, c'est très bien ça. And because they won't suspect you. You'll be wonderful for the resistance because they won't suspect you, you see.
She's a gorgeous voice. That's on Radio 1, RTÉ Doc, In the Shadow of Death. She lives into her 90s, that woman,
after that story. Lives until 1999. And that's where her surname comes from. She married a man called Count Guy O'Kelly de Galway. But he disappeared 15 years after they married, without a trace. We don't really know who the real guy was, but she survives Auschwitz, survives World War II, then loses the husband, but lives till 94, is cremated in Glasnevin.
Has a lovely life walking around.
It's a beautiful life. She's very positive outlook for someone that went through so
much.
She's on one of the cremation walls, which is very hard to find. Yeah. But again, that's one of the main points of the book.
We have to go, Warren, but there's loads of praise coming in for you. I'm currently reading this book. It's great. Warren brings the stories of these people back to life in such a relatable way, it says Paul, and someone's praising. He says, we did the grave robber tour of Warren at Halloween. It was brilliant, so entertaining for young and old. He's funny, great with the kids, brilliant stories to tell. Best of luck with the book, says Stephanie. And the book is So Once Was I, as he explained in the beginning. Warren Farrell, thanks a million.
Thanks very much, Oliver.
Good luck. Good morning to you.
Cheers.
Email oliver@rte.ie.